Before I get started, let me point out, this is Mo Shafi, and Mo is an assistant professor at HMS, an epileptologist and EEG expert, and what I'm going to tell you about is really the work of both of us, and the ideas that I'll try to share are heavily influenced by the conversations with Mo and his own work. So look at me and see Mo, or some morph of both of us. Anyway, we've been asking ourselves the question of to what degree neurophysiologic measures can meaningfully help you all as delirium experts and us as neurologists and neuroscientists, both characterize and understand and ultimately diagnose the patients and help them. How can it provide diagnostic but also prognostic insights into the outcomes? And perhaps at a deeper level, whether one can gain meaningful new neurobiological insights into the cause of delirium and the outcome of delirium. And that's what I want to tell you about, sort of talk with you about what are the opportunities and the limitations of these techniques, and how can they be combined with other tools to make them more useful, hopefully, and share a little bit of how we've been thinking about this. Don't need to convince you that delirium is a common and costly problem. Don't need to convince you that it is associated with cognitive decline and ultimately, really, a devastating condition. It leads frequently to a loss of independence. It increases mortality for patients. And if we could understand enough to actually prevent it, it would be the way to go. And so therefore, understanding the neurobiological basis becomes important, and I'll try to share a sort of conceptual model that with the help of many of the folks here, including Sharon and Ed and Rich, we've been sort of thinking about. The goal, obviously, is to fill the gap that we're faced with in our understanding of what actually causes delirium at a systems and neurological level. How can we identify individuals that might be at risk for the delirium so that we can intervene early? And on the basis of that understanding, can we deploy and test new brain-based interventions that might, at one end, sort of minimize the long-term effects, but ultimately really help prevent it. So that's the long-term goal of all this. And obviously, we're not there. But at an initial step, the question that comes up often in patients with delirium is how can we diagnose them better? How can we be sure what the heck we're dealing with? And there, electrophysiologic measures are often considered, and so it's maybe worth thinking about what do we get from them. So the electrophysiologic evaluation of patients with delirium, for the most part, I think, aims to fulfill two distinct goals. One is a diagnostic, in quotes, goal, because in a strict sense, any neurophysiologic measure that I'm going to be telling you about is rather non-specific, and so what it really serves a purpose is to rule out things that might be confounding or that might be masquerading as a delirium. One of them, obviously, is seizures, and that's the main indication for EEG, for example. Can non-convulsive seizure disorders, can an epilepsy continuous in certain brain areas cause a picture of confusion and inattention? Sure. Is it very common? No. Do we overuse EEG in these patients? Probably. Is it a good thing for the hospitals? Yep, they love it. And if you can put them on video monitoring for 4 days, even better. But does it actually change anything in the management of these patients? Frankly, no, not at all. Is it useful to support a diagnosis of encephalopathy? Well, yeah, I guess so. Do you need to see delta slowing in frontal areas to get a sense that this is probably a picture of encephalopathy? No, if you need that, you have bigger problems. But again, you know, people sort of love it, and maybe it's a valuable thing in a sense to monitor the course. And the hope is that we will learn something fundamental. But that's a hope that has been around for just about 100 years, and it's unlikely to fundamentally change in the next few years. So it's not going to really pan out. That's my gut feeling. And part of it is because of that non-specificity, but also because of the fundamental sort of correlational nature of EEG, right? So you're really assessing how the brain is functioning in a setting where you're seeing that the patient is not acting normally, even as much as the what you capture is the correlate of what you're seeing clinically. Well, you see it clinically, so you get very little extra unless you intervene in a meaningful way. And I'll try to get back to that and focus on that. I think that if we actually look for the reactivity of the EEG in response to specific inputs, we can get significantly more out of it. And whether that is in the form of traditional evoked potentials, you know, engaging the subjects in tasks, looking at the EEG in the setting of evoked potential input from sensory or otherwise, or using, as I'll show you, transcranial stimuli for a control perturbation to look at the response, I think that is probably going to be a lot more likely to lead to meaningful insights towards this goal of a neurobiological exploration. Please interrupt me if I'm talking about stuff that you A, disagree, that would be particularly useful, and B, that you want to clarify further. But that's the framing that I think be worthwhile to think about the neurophysiology in the electrophysiology in these patients. You know, we often do it. I think we overuse it in a clinical setting. We don't really need it for ruling out the things that EEG can truly rule out. But we're in the hope that it will help us sort of identify meaningful new insights. And I think that requires a more systematic framing of what it is, what hypothesis it is that you're after, that you think underlies it. And so I'm going to try to start there. So in order to do that, let me share a few sort of concepts of brain function, which I think are increasingly being broadly accepted. So I think we've come to realize more and more that normal brain function, brain health, is an evolving thing over the lifespan, right? A healthy brain at 80 is a very different beast than a healthy brain at 5. It's a good thing, because at 50, I don't want to have my 18-year-old brain. Or my son's 18-year-old brain. But exactly what that means in terms of what are those interactions is not clear. It is clear that they are flexible or plastic, that they are changing. And it is also clear, and this is something that Williams James already anticipated, that plasticity is not necessarily a good thing. Not necessarily a bad thing. It's an intrinsic property of the system. It's an intrinsic property of the dynamics of connections in the brain, and that you need, to use his terminology, the right amount of plasticity. If you have too little, well, that's bad, because you don't ever yield to influence, and therefore you don't ever change habits. That's what he was referring to. And in Cajal terminology, you don't ever learn. But if you have too much plasticity, well, that's not good either, because you yield to influence too quickly. You don't want to walk out of this room forever changed by my talking. That'd be a, you know, daunting kind of responsibility for me. But hopefully it influences your thinking a little bit. That was William James's sort of conceptualization. We need a right amount of plasticity, whatever the heck that is. But if we have too much, it's bad. If you have too little, that's also bad. So it's a system that is evolving over the lifespan, that is flexible and requires a sustaining of that flexibility. And it is that flexible, dynamic network organization that leads to behavior and cognition. So disorders of behavior and cognition can be conceptualized as circuitopathies, as alterations of networks, right? And so therefore, if that is true, key concepts would include the notion of connectivity, what actually is the nature of those connections, how are they structured, what is their dynamic range, how do the different networks interact with each other at a structural and a functional level. Ultimately, that's the Brain Initiative and the Human Connectome Project. But the other key concept is that of plasticity I was mentioning briefly, is this brain's ability to adapt, to respond to influence by changing functions and ultimately forming new connections. So if you take that framing, then one can, I think, postulate a conceptual model of delirium that takes into consideration the individual differences both in connectivity and plasticity, and that might be something along the following lines. So you can envision a baseline where you start with a given individual connectivity profile, where there might be a high connectivity or a low connectivity, either within specific networks or across networks. And then something happens. If something happens is some sort of insult. You know, you get a UTI, you stress out because you're going to have surgery, you get anesthesia, whatever the heck it is. And that is a challenge to that system, right? Think of it as a complex system. And in confronting that challenge, given plasticity as a mechanism for adaptation, there are a number of different possible consequences. One of them is that you adapt appropriately because you have quote-unquote optimal plasticity. You adapt appropriately to that stressor, given your connectivity profile, and nothing happens. That's what we all hope for. Another outcome is that you have optimal plasticity, but the stressor is particularly strong, or your connectivity profile is abnormal, and you develop delirium, but appropriately compensate. Your brain is able to respond to it in such a way that you recover quickly. If you have appropriate connectivity to begin with, but an inability because of suboptimal plasticity to respond to the insult, then you also develop delirium, and hopefully your brain is able to compensate for it and just takes longer, as it were, but you recover from it. However, if you start off with abnormal connectivity to lower connectivity and your mechanisms of plasticity are deficient, then that might be a situation where you develop complicated delirium and potentially a sustained deficit ensues. So we've been thinking of delirium basically at this multi-level interaction between your connectivity profile and your mechanisms of plasticity. And if you think about it that way, then neurophysiology becomes really important, because it becomes a way to characterize that connectivity profile and perhaps have a predictive value as to the individual risk, And as I'll show you, it allows us to actually characterize the efficacy of the mechanisms of plasticity in vivo in humans. So if we had a sort of probe of the state of individual brain function that leverages EEG, maybe structural and functional MRI, to characterize connectivity, as well as I'll show you, TMS measures, transcranial magnetic stimulation measures, to characterize the mechanisms of plasticity, that might be a way to predict that outcome. And that's the kind of research project that we're trying to pursue in collaboration with many of the folks here. So what I like to do is share with you a little bit of more detail of what those techniques look like and what do we actually know thus far. Just in a whole lot, but I'll tell you what it's not. So first, to start with EEG. So EEG, as you all know, is sort of capturing the activity, the electrical activity of the brain, transcranially mostly. And what is important to realize is that the EEG signals are really the result of the compound synchronous activity of cortical neurons that are oriented in specific direction. So it's a very small subset of neurons that we actually end up capturing. It's by no means the whole story of what is going on in the brain, obviously. EEG signals are generally described by two characteristics. One is the amplitude or the power of the overall signal. The other one is the frequency of that signal. And you can decompose the EEG activity in its different frequency bands, as you all know, and we traditionally speak of delta and theta and alpha and beta and gamma bands. You can do more fine grain and look at the amount of activity at 10 hertz or at 11 hertz or at 20 hertz. I'll show you why that is meaningful. Ultimately, what we're capturing is a direct measure of the amount of activity in form of electric activity in the mostly pyramidal neurons, and specifically capturing the consequence of synaptic current, synaptic activation. We analyze the EEG by looking at fundamentally at two things, at the local response at any one electrode as compared to another electrode, and that's where we characterize this amplitude of power versus frequency. And that's where we can decompose the EEG in different spectra, in different frequency bands, assessing the power in those frequency bands. But we can also analyze it in terms of connectivity, looking at how power, but particularly how frequency, relates between one electrode and another, whether there is a shift, whether there is a coherence between the activity in the different ones, whether they are synchronous and thus locked in phase. We can even look at the direction of information flow by looking at the timing of shifts of those frequencies. And I'll show examples of all those things and how they can be applied to different mental states. Does this all make sense? Okay. So what studies have been done with EEG in delirium? Well, a lot of studies, because it's used a lot clinically, as I was saying, whether it's meaningful or not. So not surprisingly, there is data going back a long time, looking at the EEG in terms of that power and that frequency, even in terms of that coherence in patients during delirium. And the long and short of it is EEG is abnormal in delirium. Big whooping surprise, right? If the patient is confused, not interacting, inattentive, hallucinating, and your brain measure of electric activity were to be normal, that'd be freaking surprising, right? So it's not particularly surprising that it's abnormal. Can we get something else out of the abnormality? Well, what are the abnormalities? So the most extensive sort of data that are available would suggest two things, would lead us to conclude two things. The first one is that the background activity, the overall net average activity, is slow. Okay, we'll have to think about what that means. And the second thing that we've learned is as you start getting out of delirium, as patients are getting out of delirium, the background activity speed up. So, in other words, if you're abnormal and not interacting with your environment in an appropriate way, your EEG activity is abnormal. And as you start getting more normal, your EEG activity becomes more normal. Not particularly meaningful, big revelation, at least not to me, but that's, there you have it. So what insight we get out of it in some sense is that slowness of activity is an indicator of breakdown of communication between, of connectivity between brain areas. That's really the meaningful outcome of it. And of course, you can individualize it a little bit more and say, well, it will depend on the individual baseline, and it does, and so therefore the degree of slowness depends a little bit on what your baseline is like. But it doesn't really help a whole lot more. You could ask the question, can you induce in some form a speeding up of the EEG? And if you do that, does that predict a faster recovery? And there is some suggestion that that's the case. So interventions, including brain stimulation, but interventions, including medications that may speed up the EEG, correlate with a faster recovery, whereas interventions like medications that will contribute to slowing down the EEG will worsen the duration and the length. Again, not particularly novel insight and something that you can glimpse from just the clinical experience. But that's where it is. Now, there is a bunch of follow-up studies, much more recent studies, that have basically looked at can we gain something more out of it. But what they've generally done is provide more sophisticated quantitative measures of this summary that I just gave you. You can do very quantitative computational assessments of the amount of slowing that you get, and ultimately replicated the findings. There is not a whole lot of new insight that has been gained from this. You can add measures of connectivity. You can add measures of what is called complexity, which is the range of variability in a given signal, and show that the connectivity breaks down because it's dependent, as it were, on the speed of communication. So if you slow down your overall local activity, well, your connectivity is going to break down too. And that if you have a very consistent slow EEG, you have less range of frequencies of signal, and so that is actually how we calculate complexity, and so therefore complexity also goes down. And dynamics tends to refer to the interaction between the two, and so therefore EEG dynamics, the complexity locally and the interactions between areas also breaks down. But they're all sort of expected consequences of an overall slowing of the brain activity. If you look at the numbers, and you look at sort of the distribution of activities, the different frequencies of activity in a population that has delirium versus a population that does not, in the non-hash line, you see, first of all, there is a remarkable overlap. It's speaking to this non-specificity, right? So in other words, if you were to see an EEG and do the analysis and know nothing about the patient, there is no way to reach the conclusion, oh, look, that's an EEG of somebody in delirium. But again, that's really what we've gotten out of it. So differentiating delirious from non-delirious subject, if you know which ones are in one bucket versus another, well, that gives you 80% accuracy. If you don't know, then good luck to you. So the utility is really rather limited. There are features of the EEG that correlate with the MMSE scores, that correlate with the presence of delirium and the severity of delirium. You can rule out non-convulsive status. You can, as a group, differentiate delirious from non-delirious subjects. But beyond that, to predict outcomes, to predict risk, there's nothing that has been gained that takes us there. Now, there is perhaps one approach that is worth at least you guys sort of hearing about, which is this BIS monitoring or bispectral index monitoring. And the idea there is to take a number of these parameters of the EEG and do a weighted sum of them, considering time and frequency as well as power and amplitude, adjusted appropriately for the effect of medications, anesthetic or otherwise. People have completed a trial, a double-blind trial, showing that might have some objective metric sort of meaning in terms of the severity of the delirium. And so that's sort of where the field is going, I think, in a somewhat desperate attempt of having an objective metric that we often lack in the clinical assessment of the patient. Can we get to some predictive use with something that we can quantify very, very clearly? So, that's the situation. Now, what we can definitely do is ask the question, can we contrast delirium with other conditions? Can we tease apart some underlying pathology? And people have focused on the question of whether there is underlying dementia, particularly Alzheimer's disease, or whether there might be specific forms of metabolic encephalopathy. And some of the nicest studies have been done with hepatic encephalopathy. And there, there is rather sophisticated analysis that can be applied to the EEG, combining these different metrics. And changes in EEG power correlate and predict cognition over time in patients with Alzheimer's disease. And so therefore, there is a possibility of analyzing or following the patient, characterizing their degree of cognitive decline, and having a better baseline metric against which to compare this question of, can we assess objectively the decline that might be associated with an episode of delirium. Most of those studies still have focus on slowing and on the decreased connectivity, where again, decreased connectivity measures over time are predictive of the progression of Alzheimer's disease, consistent with this notion of normal brain function that I was sharing, that depends on the activity in nodal structures as well as the connectivity across. And that is, by the way, true both in regards to Alzheimer's disease and in regards to hepatic encephalopathies. I'm convinced that leaps us forward significantly. It's a small incremental step that gives maybe more reliable metrics, but I'm not sure that it offers something fundamentally different, because it still doesn't give us a clear sense of causal relationships between behavior and what we're measuring. Now, transcranial magnetic stimulation that I mentioned briefly is a way to basically induce a perturbation, think about it that way, into the brain in the form of electromagnetic induction. You pass current through a coil that generates a magnetic field. That magnetic field pulse penetrates the skin and skull, reaches the brain, and it induces a current in the brain. It's electrode-less electric stimulation. It's injecting a certain amount of control current that disrupts the electric activity in the brain for that amount of time. If you disrupt it in the motor cortex and disrupt it enough, it actually triggers an activation of the pyramidal cells, and so you get a descending volley that ultimately gives you a muscle twitch. If you apply it to any other part of the brain, you still evoke a firing of these pyramidal cells locally, and you can therefore record with EEG a complex sort of cortical evoke response to your perturbation. And if you look at different parts of the brain, well, you get different characteristics of the perturbation because different parts of the brain have different local and circuits and connected circuits. And so you get a pattern and a distribution of evoked responses that depends on where you've imposed that perturbation. And you can then ask the question, slightly different than just with the EEG alone, how does this brain respond to the same control perturbation in different parts of the brain or in different moments in time, different times of the day, etc. So people have started doing that. For example, we know we can characterize the effect of different medications. I won't go into the details, but by predictable differences in the components of that evoked response, some of which index specifically intracortical inhibition. And so you can assess the question of the amount of intracortical inhibition in that person, in that brain area, in response to your medication dose, or in the setting of decay of function because of delirium. And ask the question then, to what degree the slowing that you see on the EEG, for example, is or is not related to a breakdown of intracortical inhibition. We can identify inhibitory deficits in disease. Most of the studies so far have focused on psychiatric patients and frontal areas, but you can see here that in healthy controls compared to patients with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, just visually the pattern is quite different, and you can quantify it very carefully, both in the spatial and the temporal domain. You can look at the relationship between the spontaneous natural frequencies of different areas and the response to the perturbation, and show that even though the baseline frequencies are not different, similar to delirium with a very large overlap, the response to the perturbation is very different and allows you to actually separate out the individuals even with a data-driven approach of cluster statistics. So it allows you to go from a correlational level of analysis to perhaps more of a causal level of analysis, which is ultimately the goal. In the setting of Alzheimer's disease, we know now that if you look at particular parts of the brain, either frontal or parietal, that you can see early on compared to healthy elderly individuals in patients with Alzheimer's disease, a very different perturbation response, a very different evoked response early in the course, and in studies that we've been doing, actually even in a preclinical state in folks that have amnestic MCI, in folks that have a positive amyloid PET and don't show any abnormalities. So furthermore, we know that it actually correlates with their cognitive ability, that the change in the evoked response correlates with the activity. But this is just a single burst that allows you, a single pulse that allows you to look at the local response and the connectivity. But I started off saying we want to conceptualize it properly. We need to capture both that reactivity and the plasticity. And in order to measure plasticity, we can do to the human brain, remarkably, the same thing we can do to a slice of, of cortex. We can apply a single pulse, that's what I've told you about so far, and measure the response, and then apply a train of stimuli, a burst of stimulation, and afterwards test the response to the burst again. To the pulse again, sorry. So if you have a given baseline response after a burst, depending on the characteristics of that burst, you get either a potentiation of the response after intermittent stimulation or a suppression of the response after continuous stimulation. Same thing you all might remember from hippocampal slices leading to basically probing the efficacy of those synapses that you're probing. Here is not a single synapse we're probing, we're probing a whole messy kind of chunk of brain, but you can do the exact same responses. And just like in a slice preparation, after 4 seconds of a burst of stimulation, you get, you know, 30, 40 minutes of either potentiation or suppression. This is not the consequences of plasticity, this is probing the efficacy of the mechanisms of plasticity, really. And when you do that in different disease states, in different disorders, you find that patients with Alzheimer's disease have a significant decrease in the efficacy of this potentiation-like response, while the depression-like response is normal. And it's specific to some degree to different disorders, because in the autism spectrum disorders, for example, what you get is an abnormally enhanced response. They are more plastic. They're too plastic in the Williams-James settings. We can explore the pharmacology of this, but we can also show, just like in the EEG setting, that in disorders that cause encephalopathies, like minimal hepatic encephalopathy, patients also have decreased plasticity in response to these TMS pulses compared to healthy controls. And so I think we have the tools, when combining EEG with a control perturbation, by the way, that you can do exactly the same way in a 15-year-old and in an 80-year-old. You can do exactly the same way in an animal model and a human, and you can do exactly the same way over and over and over again in the person, in the patient, before, during, and following a course of, or an episode of delirium. And so we have a way to assess those two concepts that I was starting off with, of connectivity and plasticity, in a reliable, measured way. So what I hope to have shared a little bit of is that in using these tools, we can maybe gain some insights into the neurobiology. I don't know that we get a whole lot of more than what we already have learned with neurophysiology in the evaluation of patients with delirium, but by adding these novel ways of analyzing, particularly of perturbing the brain, we can explore beyond the diagnostic question into some insights into the neurobiology, and particularly we can at least frame a conceptual model and test it, the one that we've been playing around, as I was mentioning, conceptualizes delirium as a breakdown of the normal network function in response to stressors, where the inability to compensate appropriately is a function of the baseline connectivity and the individual plasticity, both of which we can carefully and precisely characterize. Maybe I'll stop there. Yeah. Thank you.
So we're running, we have to stay on time for mock reviews, but we do have time for maybe just one or two questions.
Okay. Hey, Wes.
That was very helpful. I like the way you kind of humbly showed us, well, you showed us that we should be humble about what we've learned and what we know, and about how much this advances our thinking. Why do you think it's been so difficult for us to quantify in a way that was meaningful clinically, like the degree of slowing or connectivity? Neither of them have really panned out very much to help us with prognosticating about degrees of delirium or the dose of delirium. And it, I mean, anybody who likes toys would have thought that this toy would have been a way to go, but it hasn't panned out well. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I love toys. I mean, this is what I do for a living. So I love the toys. And I agree with you that you know, the feeling is, the information is there, right? So why is it that it's been so elusive? And of course, one pass of answer is, well, we've been approaching it too simplistically, right? So you put 32 electrodes or 64 electrodes, and you just look at the qualitative impression. That's often what we do. Well, it's only going to take you so far. So that was the initial sort of impression, right? And so leading to more quantitative measures, so we should be able to extract more. Turns out, not so far. Why? Maybe because our quantitative measures are still too simplistic, and that's why I think approaches like these Bayes and similarly integrative indices that take into consideration frequency, so spatial and temporal domains, and complex interactions over time, over a time period, it might be maybe more meaningful. I think the problem, though, at the conceptual level, is that fundamentally, that's what I was trying to argue, fundamentally, you don't control the input. And so you have a lot of variable responsivity of that individual to input, including the sensation of the electrodes and the sounds in the room and all this kind of stuff, that have such a big impact if your individual brain responsivity is abnormal, that it dwarfs whatever is going on, and so it becomes too noisy, and so you would need too much. That's basically the way we've been thinking about it. If we can control a perturbation, maybe you can extract a lot more by quantitating carefully the response on the EEG, similarly to what we're doing, but basically defining a baseline, which otherwise we don't have.
Yeah, there's the noise of the brain in response to the things in the room, because these rooms are highly monitored. There's beeps and buzzers, and there's also the noise from EMG as well, which is hard to sift out from the tools like the BIS or the Masimo SedLine, et cetera. So do you hope that these newer techniques of screening out the EEG, or is there any hope in your mind of screening out such noise?
I think so, but the, you know, you can certainly put a filter that is becoming increasingly reliable to take out a band of frequency. Of course, the problem that you run into there is that the EMG frequency bands overlap in a big part with meaningful electroencephalographic bands, gamma and so forth, and so we're no doubt taking out part of the meaningful activity in the brain, and by virtue of that shifting overall to a slower band of activity, we're probably that's not where the main action is. And so in dealing with what we know to be artifacts and confounders, we are taking out signal that is meaningful. But to be fair, even intracortical recording in the few cases that have been done haven't really yielded a whole lot more. And I still think it's in part because of a noisy brain, and like you were saying. And the question is, how do we conceptualize it? I have the feeling that we have a more predictable and repeatable and reproducible baseline. That's why we've been thinking of these perturbations, that one may get more meaningful insights.